I have Chokhar on the line, and Chokhar is a former Olympia resident and Evergreen student, also an ISM member who has traveled to Palestine, and now Joe is in Iraq. I guess to start this off, what were some of your reasons for going to Iraq?
Well, I feel that it's really important that internationals are here to witness the ongoing U.S. occupation. You know, the U.S., I believe, intentionally let the security situation get so bad that internationals would be afraid to be here so that they could have a free hand in their occupation. And it would be, you know, it's absurd for the activist community to let the U.S. get away with that. So risk or not, I felt it was important to come here and document the situation and stand with Iraqis in their time of suffering.
What's the name of the group you're with, and how did you get involved in them?
The group's called the Christian Peacemaker Teams. They have violence de-escalation projects all over the world in different conflict zones. I originally ran into them in Palestine while I was working with the International Solidarity Movement. They helped found ISM and do a lot of their trainings and other organizing with them, and seemed like a really solid group that made it possible to have long-term committed presence in different places. And they provide good funding and training and support and things like that. So I got involved with them right after I graduated from Evergreen in order to work with them in Palestine. And then recently when I was denied entry to Palestine by Israel, I came over to work with their team in Iraq.
Well, what were some of your first impressions of Iraq once you got off the plane?
Well, my first impressions were that it was strikingly normal, you know, that it had been built up as this very intense, dangerous war zone. But, you know, life is going on as normal as it can. And, you know, Iraqis going out doing the day-to-day things. Us and our small team here going out shopping and doing day-to-day. And it was just like a normal city. Of course, eventually, you start hearing explosions and seeing the tank convoys and waiting around the checkpoints, and you start to realize how the occupation works. But certainly, life is going on.
So you've met people, and you've written stories about your experiences so far. And in one of the stories, you talk about a guy named Shaggy. Can you tell us about Shaggy?
Mm-hmm. Shaggy, yeah. Yeah, he's a 24-year-old young Iraqi. He's a Palestinian Iraqi, actually, part of the Palestinian refugee community here. Very dynamic, outgoing fellow, and he and I have gotten to be pretty good friends, actually. He originally got a job working as a translator with the U.S. Forces when they first came in, but eventually they fired him because he, as a Palestinian, didn't have the citizenship documentation to prove his security or something. And a few weeks after he was fired, they came and arrested him, and he was detained in a U.S. detention center for almost a year, about 11 months, Camp Buka in the south, in which, you know, point they also used his translating skills while he was detained, and he had a pretty good rapport with the soldiers, I understand. But he's also, you know, just experienced an enormous amount of hardship for a man his age. He worked as during the invasion, he worked as a kind of first aid medic, on a first aid medic team. It was just any Iraqi who could volunteer could come and just kind of dig bodies out of rubble and, you know, try and verify identities of bodies to try and track their families and things like that, and was pretty close to a couple of explosions and has been around a lot of death and suffering.
Wow. In another one of your communiques back home, you talked about meeting resistance fighters. Can you explain that situation and how you became, you know, to actually meet these people?
Yeah, I don't want to give too many details about the circumstances under which I met him, but and I certainly can't verify that it was true or not, you know, that whether he was a fighter or not, but he said he was from Fallujah, and seven of his family members had been killed during the U.S. invasion, which is an all-too-common story for Fallujans, actually. But he had said he had been part of the resistance there and had fought the Americans during the first invasion. He's now living in Baghdad, but was very, very adamant that there were no foreign fighters in Fallujah. It was a tribal city, and Fallujah were all going to defend the city when Americans wanted to invade. And he and his, you know, fellow Fallujans defended that. They were also adamant that they hated Saddam and were glad to see Saddam taken out of power. However, the United States occupation has become as bad and worse in some ways than Saddam. Particularly because they're foreigners, it's even harder to deal with their oppression. And so they're going to fight the Americans until they leave.
You talked about, I got a little quote from one of the things you wrote, and it says, "To sum up what I've learned from this man, Iraqis are armed, trained, and pissed off at the Americans and their puppet Iraqi government. They're not Saddam loyalists, and they're not foreign fighters. They love for their families, and their love for their freedom, and they'll fight occupation to the death." I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. That's another major thing I learned from him was how armed, trained the resistance really is. You know, Saddam required all Iraqis, particularly the men, to be military trained. They started in high school, and then after high school, some more intense training. And so they've all been fairly well trained, and then also their weapons were all over the black market after the invasion, because Saddam's weapon storages were not very well protected by the U.S. and were completely looted. So there's lots and lots of weapons, not just small arms, but rocket launchers, anti-aircraft, anti-tank weapons that the Americans are finding are, you know, a very big problem for them. And it's believed that American casualties and losses of tanks and UAVs is much higher than they actually report, given eyewitness reports of various damaged equipment and American bodies. It seems like the resistance may be far more successful than is even being reported.
You mentioned that the divide and conquer tactic that the U.S. military is trying to impose between Sunnis and Shia Muslims. I was wondering what your eyewitness accounts of that has been like.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The conquer strategy of imperialists is a very significant aspect of the conflict in Iraq. Not just the current one, but previous ones. The different tribes that make up the country of Iraq were intentionally grouped together in what is considered Iraq by the British occupation in order to keep them fighting with each other and ensure British rule and control of their oil resources and natural gas resources. And so that strategy has been continued by imperialists, and now the U.S. has adopted it as well. The Sunni and the Shia in particular have a lot of tension right now. The U.S. has been very actively furthering divisions. Saddam was Sunni, and the British had favored the Sunnis and put them into power, and Saddam had brutally repressed and oppressed the Shia and the Kurds. And now that the U.S. has come in, they put the Sunni out of power and now put the Shia back in power, put the Shia in power, and largely favored the Shia. So there's decades of tension from the British divide and conquer strategy, and now the U.S. is only aggravating by favoring the Shia and the Kurds and against the Sunnis, who, you know, have a large part of the administration and military training from under Saddam. So it's really a situation that was set up to fail. You know, it seems pretty obvious to me that the United States is intentionally building these divisions to make Iraq very unstable so that they will justify their foreign occupation and keep Iraq from becoming an independent, stable country that could actually control its own resources and therefore become independent and powerful.
You mentioned in your trip to Fallujah, in a second, hopefully you can describe what Fallujah looks like, but you mentioned that the U.S. occupation fired the Sunni police officers in Fallujah and brought in Shia police officers. I was wondering what effect that had on the city of Fallujah.
Yeah, Fallujah is a really hard city I only went there for a day, and it was really, really depressing, really sad. It was completely destroyed. Entire neighborhoods turned into rubble. Every structure, you know, has some kind of damage. Every third building or so is almost completely destroyed. You know, bullet holes everywhere. And it's just a really, really devastated. It looks like it's been through a hurricane or some kind of insane natural disaster. and the occupation forces are incredibly visible, even more so than in Baghdad. They're driving through all the time, tanks, Humvees, and Iraqi security services, and pickup trucks, and other vehicles. And the hatred for them is just incredibly intense. You know, from being in Palestine and being in Baghdad, people kind of get used to the passing occupation forces, and don't kind of, you know, sit at them or look at them intensely every time. But in Fallujah, every time when I was on the street and they drive by, people just glare at them and just like are just so full of hatred for this foreign occupying power. Not just the U.S., obviously, but the Shia security services who's brought down from the south, down from Karbala in the south, they brought them up to Fallujah intentionally to spread the tension. And it, completely unnecessarily, Fallujah had, you know, police and security services that knew how to take care and control the city, and the U.S. fired all of those police officers, around 1,600 police officers that they are, or 16,000 police officers that they fired, and are now out of work and possibly involved in the resistance because they, you know, have nothing else to do. And so it's a real tense, real problem situation.
How would you say the occupation in Iraq is similar or different from your experiences in Palestine?
That's a good question. I think it's really important to think about the similarities as well as the differences. Certainly, as far as similarities go, the tactics are all very, very similar. The fact that it's documented that the U.S. has brought Israeli officials into the Pentagon to Iraq in order to school them on how to occupy the country. Certainly the checkpoints, both the permanent and the roving checkpoints that just show up out of nowhere, the difficulty of movement, going from point A to point B is critical because of all the different road closures and checkpoints that are set up. The same thing's true in Baghdad and Iraq. There's checkpoints all over and a lot of roads are closed. And particularly related to military convoys or any kind of U.S. presence, just as in Palestine, any kind of Israeli military or settlement areas are, you know, they have no problem inconveniencing thousands of Palestinians for the sake of a few hundred settlers or soldiers. Same thing's true in Baghdad, the Green Zone, where several thousand internationals and troops live. Inconveniences Baghdad significantly, right in the middle. And so to go anywhere in Baghdad from point A to point B is very difficult. You have to go well around it, and the way the geography works makes it very inconvenient. Random detention and use of torture on the part of the U.S. military is also very common in Palestine. People can be detained for anything at any moment and will be very, very, very mistreated, and then held without charge with no rights for long periods of time. This is ongoing in Iraq and has been going on in Palestine for a long time. Certainly assassinations, collect punishment is very common. If fighters will attack U.S. forces from an area, they'll go into the whole neighborhood and detain everybody and raid houses, and you know, that kind of collective punishment is really common. Human and major differences, of course, the part of the Iraqis is very different. It's really hard, actually, for me to see Iraqis fighting each other, afraid of each other, not directing at all the occupation force. The enemy is the Israeli occupation, and then Palestinians, you know, are their allies. That's definitely a huge difference. The permanence of the Israeli occupation is disturbing. It's pretty clear to me that the United States tends to stay for a long time, but they're not transferring civilian population in the way that Israel is into the Palestinian territories and making a permanent presence in that regard. So a lot of Iraqis who believe the U.S. Will leave, or at least could be forced to leave, whereas many Palestinians have lost hope in having their own independent state because the settlements are so massive and so permanent. And so the occupation position is differently in that regard. Economic woman or us here right now, I'm sure a lot of the government is out and we're seeing a lot of U.S. products flooded the markets of Iraq since the invasion, also Israeli products flooded the market cheaper and trying to put Iraqi stores out of business, and Israel's largely done this already in Palestine, but it's in a newer stage of development here in Iraq.
I'm curious about the media, the mass media in Iraq. Here in the United States, any information coming out of Iraq is heavily censored and state-controlled. I'm wondering what the mass media in Iraq is like.
Yeah, it's hard to even say that it's in Iraq at all, because most of the major networks can't hardly even leave the Green Zone, which is this very fortified area in Baghdad that, you know, you can't get any even remote impression of what it's like to be in Iraq while you're inside of it. But a lot of NGO and UN offices, as well as a lot of media, are not allowed to leave those fortified compounds. And even the ones that do leave in heavily armed convoys, on which they are afraid to talk to, you know, average Iraqis, and average Iraqis are afraid to talk to them, and they live in, you know, constant fear. So you're never going to get adequate understanding of a situation when you go at it like that. And the mass media is largely taking their information directly from the U.S. military, who tells them what happens, and they report on it. The military even provides them pictures and footage that is tailored in a certain way to, you know, fulfill the U.S. needs, but is also, you know, exciting and sexy footage that the networks will like. And networks are anxious to run it because, you know, if the U.S. gives it to them, if one network runs it, they all need to run it, because then suddenly they'll be seen as if they didn't have it or something. So the U.S. has been very active in controlling and manipulating the media, both by making the security situation so dangerous, you know, for journalists that they feel unsafe to actually go out and footage, but also by doing these tactics of providing footage and manipulating the way the message is getting out.
What are your thoughts on journalism and how journalists are embedded with the troops more often than not in Iraq?
The embedding process was a brilliant move on the part of the Americans. The idea is that you make your journalists completely dependent on these troops, and therefore they will become portraying them in a favorable light. And actually, a very strong principle of journalism is that you don't take anything from the people that you're covering, you know, so that you're objective. But in the embedded situation, they're not only taking everything, their food, their housing, their transportation, but also their very lives are dependent on these U.S. troops. So of course they're going to end up favoring the troops and portraying things in a positive light for the troops. In particular, because there's a lot of energy put into saying that any kind of negative portrayal could get them killed or could get them be actually harmful to the U.S. troops in their physical safety, and they never wanted to do that, so they end up coming up with very, very biased pro-U.S. reporting. And then you combine that with pressure from editors to be seen as pro-America and patriotic, and then even the U.S. population who, you know, voice in the media wanting it to be in a very certain way. And you end up with a very problematic situation. An independent journalist has broken away from the thing and got real reports are amazing. And the things that they've been able to come out with are phenomenal. Dar Jamil, in particular, is an amazing amount of work just traveling independently with translators around the world. Following, you know, U.S. invasions of different cities and doing incredible journalism that proves that it really is possible. There's no reason that they couldn't be doing it. Clearly, that the U.S. has manipulated them in a way to keep them from doing it.
Well, one thing that the U.S. military has been very successful in manipulating is controlling the amount of human stories coming out of Iraq, the human side of things. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a story of some people that you've met while in Iraq and the human side of the occupation.
Right, well, firstly, you know, people are trying to live their lives, you know, so it is an occupation, it is a war zone, it's very dangerous, but people go to work, they go to school, you know, they cook food, you know, they visit family members, their weddings, you know, they're graduating, they're taking final exams, you know, they're going to parties, hanging out with their friends, and, you know, that life is going on. Certainly, life is difficult. The electricity situation and the water situation is incredibly difficult. Electricity is on for about 3 hours and then off for 3 hours and on for 3 hours, and some people have a diesel generator, most people have a generator, but can't run it all the time, can't afford to have it on all the time, or it's not always functioning, and so people are without electricity for large parts of the day. All water is unfit to drink, so we have to boil water and filter it, and many effects from the water. And so there are hazards like that, but people are really going on. They are pretty scarred, you know, they're Iraqi people have undergone a lot of suffering, both from oppression from Saddam, from 10 years of U.S. sanctions, which they had a very difficult time getting food and medical supplies, and now this very, very aggressive, violent invasion in which U.S. just dropped so much weapons and bombs on their cities and villages, and now this ongoing occupation, ongoing casualties from U.S. troops, newer Russian troops, but also the resistance, as well as foreign terrorists who do have a presence in Iraq. They're not the majority of the occupation, but they are wreaking havoc on Iraqi society, bombing churches, bombing mosques, bombing schools, assassinating professors, shelling international, that kind of thing. That the U.S. intentionally allows to stay in order to keep the security situation bad. And so, you know, they live in that kind of fear, as well as scars from past suffering, but they are going on with their lives.
I'm curious, what are your plans from here? Where do you plan on visiting next, and how long do you plan on staying in Iraq?
I'm actually leaving in a few days. I leave on June 7th, on Tuesday. And so I'm pretty much trying to wrap up my experience here, do some last bit of writing, and probably do some debrief and work with the team here and talk about what they're doing next, and make sure that I know and stuff can be discussed, and get some teammates who are going to integrate, and say goodbye, and getting my final impressions is really the next immediate steps. I am planning to go back to Pakistan after a month or so in the States.
I'm curious, from your experience in Iraq, what kind of messages would you have for the peace movement here in the United States and abroad?
Well, the situation in Iraq is very bad and not going to get any better. Indeed, the U.S. Wants it to get worse and will continue to make it get worse in order to justify their presence. There is no easy solution to this conflict. The U.S. has created a very intense quagmire where they have created this, put Iraq on the brink of civil war, and then justify their presence by saying they're going to prevent the civil war, but of course only are making the civil war worse. And so I've created a situation where their occupation is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so the peace movement, or I believe must be an anti-U.S. imperialism movement, must become far, far more aggressive. We need to become far more creative in our tactics in resisting these policies. There is no easy solution like, oh, pull out of Iraq, or, oh, you know, stop sending money to Israel. These are important things that need to happen, but they're far from the entire solution. I believe that really the only solution is going to come from a complete overthrow and collapse of the U.S. Capitalist imperial system, in which case we as activists have to become far more creative, far more organized, did we resist this occupation and resist this imperialism? People in occupied countries are resisting. Iraqis are very actively resisting the occupation in a variety of ways. Palestinians are actively resisting the Israeli occupation, and people all over the third world are questioning and rising up against the U.S. empire. So it's up to us in the belly of the beast, as it were, us Americans, to join the third world in their struggle and to really kind of get off our asses and realize that it's going to take sacrificing privileges. It's going to take taking risks. I mean being very, very militant, aggressive, and creative in our resistance.
Do you have anything you'd like to add before we go today?
Well, I certainly want to thank you and activists in Olympia. I learned a whole lot from that community and the scene there. And independent media is really, really important in this struggle. And it's very important that we get the message out. So I really appreciate efforts like Free Radio Olympia and other independent media movements around the world. And certainly want to give my appreciation and support to your movements there, and give a shout out to all my old crew.
Right on. This is Joe Carr, live from Iraq. Thank you so much, Joe.
Sure. For more information, you can check out my website, which is www.lovinrevolution.org. That's LOVIN revolution.org.
And people, can people contact you through that website?
Absolutely. Yeah, my email is prominent.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, DJ.